Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in today for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. As early as today, President Trump is expected to overrule the FBI and the Justice Department and approve the public release of a memo written by Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee that seeks to discredit the FBI's Russia investigation. Chairman Devin Nunes denies accusations from Democrats on the committee that he improperly altered the memo that was given to the president to review. This morning, House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi called for Nunes's removal from the Intelligence Committee. Joining us now is Malcolm Nance, who's a career intelligence officer and author of the book, The Plot to Hack America. Malcolm, welcome back.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And what do you think is in this memo?
Well, we can only determine right now until it's released the outlines based on what people have been saying in, on news media. And we understand that it involves the process to get a foreign intelligence surveillance court warrant against one individual. That's Carter Page. And we're not quite sure what Nunes is asserting, but it may be that somehow during the collection of intelligence against this individual, there may have been incidental collection against the names of other people in the Trump administration, and that somehow nefariously these things were used, were outed and were being used by the FBI. We're not sure, but it doesn't matter. Whatever happens here, we know that this information is coming from a top secret special compartmented information level report that was part of the FISA court process, and that it was cherry-picked from the 400 or so pages that these warrant documents are down to 4 pages. And that means that there is no context whatsoever, and it could be manipulated into any type.
And many are concerned that there are national security implications of releasing this memo. What do you think, and what might those be?
And you're absolutely right. If this was in fact true, if something occurred with a U.S. citizen, the foreign intelligence agencies can read through the blank spaces and the methodologies that they may have used with a U.S. citizen or another source will immediately disappear. They will be closed up, as we call it. You know, they'll be scrubbed clean. Another thing is that we don't know what the status of Carter Page was, if it in fact is Carter Page. Let's just assume that it's him. We don't know whether he was actually an asset of the FBI at the time that he was carrying this out. He may have been a double agent, and that could possibly expose him and anything that he's collected. It appears that this is now, they have politicized, Devin Nunes has politicized the process of collecting counterintelligence material. And when I say counterintelligence, that means our ability to hunt out foreign spies. And he's doing it for political purposes to protect the president, which in and itself is suspicious.
Do you expect anybody to lose their job over this, whether it be Rod Rosenstein or Christopher Wray, the head of the FBI?
You know, it doesn't matter. I don't know what the White House is thinking. I don't know whether they read, you know, all the president's men and decided that, you know, mimicking Richard Nixon's actions would be the best thing that could happen. The investigators on the ground cannot be stopped. This is an avalanche, and they are still collecting and doing their day-to-day work. You can fire Rosenstein and you can fire Mueller. That is a political catastrophe that the White House would bring down upon itself. But they will not be able to stop the information that was collected and can be collected.
Malcolm Nance, I want to ask you about something else. There was a meeting that was held in Washington last week between top Russian spy chiefs and CIA Director Mike Pompeo to discuss joint counterterrorism measures. Now, those kinds of meetings, according to the Washington Post, are not unheard of. But what do you make of it?
Well, you're right. They aren't unheard of. They're usually done in an international meeting context, like over at Davos. They are done for very specific cooperative agendas, terrorists who are operating in the wild world. They're usually done through liaison officers, whether that's in northern Syria, whether that's in, you know, Berlin or Moscow. What this was almost a ministerial level meeting. And the only way this meeting could have occurred was that Donald Trump working through back channels with Moscow, coordinated this meeting and then ordered the director of national intelligence and the director of the CIA to sit down with the three individuals who are suspected of having hacked the U.S. election and to have a meeting in Washington in order to discuss counterterrorism. That story is the next breaking scandal in this administration.
That's Malcolm Nance, career intelligence officer and author of the book, The Plot to Hack America. Malcolm, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
And a CIA spokesman gave the following statement to the Washington Post about that meeting. Rest assured that any interaction with foreign intelligence agencies would have been conducted in accordance with U.S. law and in consultation with appropriate departments or agencies.
Well, people convicted of marijuana-related crimes in California could have their criminal records wiped away now that recreational pot is legal in the state. The district attorneys of San Francisco and San Diego are moving to clear the records of thousands of low-level marijuana offenses as far back as 1975. San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon joins us now. And Mr. Gascon, when California legalized recreational pot, it also allowed people with marijuana convictions to petition the state to have them overturned. But it sounds like you're going back and doing the work for them.
Well, we are, and there are several reasons. Number one, when Proposition 64 passed, it passed overwhelmingly, and it really was a clear message by the public and the voters here in California that they were tired of the war on drugs, the war on marijuana, and they wanted to go back and unwind some of the damage that had been done.
What is that damage?
Well, the damage was you had entire communities, especially when we're talking about the African-American community and communities of colors, where you had entire groups of people that were convicted of felonies and misdemeanors. That meant that they could not get public housing. They were not, those who were convicted of felonies can vote, can get student loans, can get housing, can get employment. And within Prop 64, there is a provision for the people to petition the court, but that process requires a hiring attorney. They come to court. They have to jump through a lot of hoops, and I don't think that was a voter's intent. Hmm. So what we did here is we actually analyzed the process, and we determined that we, without being prompted, we could dismiss all the misdemeanor cases en masse with the assistance of the court, and then we could go back and review all the felony convictions to determine the ones that would qualify to be resentenced to a misdemeanor.
Now, I want to ask you about those felony cases. There are about 5,000 of them that you're considering, and I'm looking at your statement announcing this new policy change, and you said people will be considered who were convicted of possession with intent to sell marijuana, people who were convicted of sales, furnishing, and transportation of marijuana. Now, those are pretty serious crimes. I'm sure a lot of people are wondering how you make sure people are benefiting from this policy who actually deserve it.
Right. So under Proposition 64, if that was the only offense that you were convicted of, you're qualified to have that resentenced down to a misdemeanor. Now, if you have other convictions, violent crimes, and there's a whole number of other crimes, then you do not qualify. So that's why the review is necessary. But let's go back to the central piece of your question of those being serious crimes. They are because we were in a state of prohibition, right? That's like saying that the people that were selling liquor during the period of prohibition were serious criminals. Yeah, they were the ones that were killing people and organized crime that actually was created as a byproduct of prohibition, right? Mm. The problem with a lot of the people that were convicted of sales in this state and around the country, quite frankly, were hand-to-hand sales, very low quantities, undercover officers in the street, and a lot of people were selling, quite frankly, for subsistence. There were people that were just really caught up in the circumstances of really bad public policy.
Sure. I hear your point. Now, I know that there will be critics of this law who will say something to the effect of, that may be true, but at the time of their convictions, they broke the law that was on the books. And shouldn't they still be held accountable for what they did? Because at the time, it wasn't legal, whether you liked it or not.
Yeah, and that is a good point. My response to that would be, if you committed this crime December 31st of 2017 in California, you could be a felon. The same act, January 1 of 2018, you're a misdemeanor. It makes absolutely no sense from a moral standpoint. Now, if you want to be strict constructionist of the law and you want to ignore human realities and human conditions, then I think your argument holds water. But I think if you look at it at sort of a more broader perspective, I think that you would agree with me.
Yeah. Well, as you know, California has been loosening marijuana laws at the same time as the federal government under the Trump administration has been restricting some of their policies. Attorney General Jeff Sessions recently rolled back Obama-era instructions to federal prosecutors, telling them to limit the types of prosecutions they pursue. Is your new policy a response to that?
You know, in part. And in fact, I think that what the Justice Department is doing by continuing to insist that marijuana be determined to be a Schedule I drug, which, by the way, puts marijuana on the same level as heroin. Now, every high school kid knows that that is BS, right? But yeah, we continue to insist almost that marijuana is like an existential threat. It's hypocritical. It doesn't really follow the reality of our country. And what it does is it takes away from the credibility of the entire criminal justice system.
Hmm. George Gascon, District Attorney of San Francisco, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
What makes something popular? Be it a movie or a song or a politician. That's the subject of a book by Atlantic senior editor Derek Thompson, which is out in paperback this month. It's called Hitmakers: How to Succeed in an Age of Distraction. I spoke with Derek when the book was first published, and I asked him if, after all his research, he found out what does make something popular.
So the book Hitmakers has two theses, which I think I can summarize in seven words. Familiarity beats novelty, and distribution beats content. So what does that mean? Familiarity beats novelty. We want to like new things, new songs, new movies. But what most of us gravitate toward are familiar surprises, new products and ideas that remind us of old products and ideas. The second thesis, distribution beats content. We also want to think that the best songs and shows and ideas will inevitably become the most popular. But the most interesting and the most important story of a new product is the story of how it got to audiences. Without distribution, a great product is doomed to oblivion, no matter how wonderful.
Well, let's go through some of the examples that you get to in here, because they're very interesting and they really span pop culture and politics and all kinds of things. You write about somebody named Raymond Loewy, who was remarkably good at predicting what would be popular. And he had a theory called MAYA, most advanced yet acceptable. What does that mean?
Raymond Loewy might be the most significant commercial artist of the 20th century, and it's ludicrous, really, how few people know his name. He was the Steve Jobs before Steve Jobs. This man and his firm designed the Exxon logo, the Lucky Strike pack, the Greyhound bus, the modern tractor, oven, refrigerator, vacuum cleaner. So how in the world did he know what all these people wanted? His theory, as you said, was MAYA, most advanced yet acceptable. He said people are torn between two forces: neophobia, a fear of new things, and neophilia, a desire to consume new ideas and products. And he said, if you want to sell something familiar, you have to make it a little bit surprising. But to sell something surprising, you have to make it a little bit familiar.
And to that point, you point out in this book that in movies, in 15 of the last 16 years, the highest grossing movie in the U.S. has been a sequel. So maybe something surprising, but also familiar.
Sequels, reboots, comic book universe extensions. And I brought this up with one film executive who said, you know, people say TV is in a golden age and the movies are obsessed with sequels. But you know what a television show is? It's an hour of entertainment followed by a bunch of sequels. Hmm. So new episodes of familiar conflicts turns out to be what audiences want from just about everything.
Speaking of movies, you point to an example in this book of something that became a hit, but it didn't become a hit at first. It became a hit after it was associated with a movie. This is the 1954 song by Bill Haley and his Comets. This is Rock Around the Clock.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad flag.
Okay, so everybody knows this song, and they know now that it was a hit, but it wasn't a hit at first. What happened?
It's the number one rock and roll song of all time. It's the second best-selling single in music history. I don't know how you can listen to it without tapping your foot. But when the song came out in 1954, it was a B-side, and a lot of people didn't tap their foot. It was mostly ignored. And here, this is the crazy, wonderful story of Rock Around the Clock. One of the few people who buys this song is a fifth-grade boy named Peter Ford. Peter is the son of a movie star, Glenn Ford, who appears in the 1955 movie Blackboard Jungle. And Glenn Ford, the movie star, is having drinks with the film's director. And the director says, you know, by the way, I need a jump jive tune for this film. Do you have any ideas? And Glenn Ford goes, well, my son, Peter, give the director some of your favorite music. And lo and behold, this 9-year-old boy hands the director Rock Around the Clock. The song plays at the beginning of Blackboard Jungle, in the middle of Blackboard Jungle, at the end of Blackboard Jungle, and only then, a few weeks after the movie comes out, does it become the number one song in America, the first rock and roll song to ever hit number one on Billboard.
And your point here is that it's not the quality of the song that made it a hit, because if it had been, it would have become a hit at the very beginning. So what was it? Why did people like it the second time around?
This goes right to the second thesis of the book. Content is less important than distribution. You have the same song come out in two different mediums, two different ways. One, in 1954, it comes out and it's kind of a flop. 12 months later, it comes out and it is the top-selling song of the decade, the second best-selling song in the history of rock and roll. So what is the actual quality of the song? You can't say. What matters is distribution and exposure.
We're speaking with Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, whose new book is called Hitmakers. And Derek, on the point that you were just talking about, you also bring up the example of impressionist art. And some people may disagree with this part of it, because you make the point that a lot of the famous artwork that we know today is famous because a particular person in France decided to make it available to the public to see.
That's right. So as everybody knows, the Impressionists were widely ignored in the mid to late 19th century, and today they're among the most popular painters in the world. What happened? Well, an incredible number of the most famous Impressionist paintings come from one collection belonging to a lesser-known Impressionist named Gustave Caillebotte. Gustave Caillebotte dies early in his 40s, in the early 1890s. He bequeaths his entire collection to the Musée du Luxembourg. Essentially, the Musée de Luxembourg takes his collection, and when they hang it, it is the first time ever that Impressionist art has the imprimatur of the French government saying, yes, we are allowing this to hang in a public museum. So that generation's art historians write about those paintings, and the next generation's art historians read those generation's art historians about those paintings. And so the power of this initial moment of exposure snowballs such that these random paintings that Caillebotte collected turns out to be paintings that we can't help but see. They're absolutely everywhere. One of his paintings by Renoir, Bal du Golem de la Galette, was discarded. Nobody would buy it. Gustave Caillebotte only bought it because he wanted to be nice to his friend Renoir. In the late 20th century, this painting sold for more than $90 million to be the second most expensive painting in the history of art. So the same art pieces that were absolutely ghastly from the perspective of an 1870s art historian are now considered absolute classics 140 years later.
And to the person who listens to you say that and says, well, they are brilliant pieces of art.
If they're brilliant pieces of art, they should be as brilliant in 1870 as they are in 1970 and 2016. But the fact is they're not. And we see this as a story of culture across pop culture categories, that there are all sorts of ideas like Impressionism or the last one I mentioned, rock and roll, that are scandal, scandal, scandal. And then they have this moment of public consecration. And after that, they become culture.
One more category we have to go into, especially when we're talking about how things become popular, is politics, because these are people, politicians, who are trying to get popular support for themselves and for their ideas. And you get into that in this book and bring up some of the rhetorical tricks that politicians have used in the past. Tell us about those.
Yeah, musicologists have shown that repetition is the God particle of music. You can take essentially any sound, even the sound of a human voice, and start repeating it again, start repeating it again, start repeating it again, And the brain will suddenly just begin to hear that cacophony as music. Da-da-da-da-da-dun, da-da-da-da-da-dun. So repetition has this powerful, amazing trick of turning cacophony into music. It's also true of speech, of political rhetoric. Basically, every single example of Greek high political rhetoric is a form of repetition. There's anaphora, which is repetition at the beginning of a sentence. Winston Churchill, we shall fight them on the beaches. We shall fight them on the landing grounds.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields.
There's tricolon, which is repetition in short triplicate. Abraham Lincoln, government of the people, by the people, for the people. There's diacopy, which is repetition of a word or phrase with a brief interruption, like FDR. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Or an ABA structure. Sarah Palin, drill, baby, drill.
We will drill here and drill now. And now's when you chant, drill, baby, drill. Yes.
And then there's the most famous example of repetition in rhetoric. It's called antimetaboly. You don't remember that word. Just remember ABBA. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Or Hillary Clinton. Human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights.
Human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights, once and for all.
And that resonates because we hear it and it sounds musical to us?
Yes, that's exactly right. It works because the brain processes the music first and wants to fall in love with the music. And so we allow sometimes questionable political ideas to just flow by because they're presented in beautiful and musical ways. So this is both, yes, a trick, but also something for audiences to watch out for because it is a way for politicians to turn any terrible idea into music.
Derek, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
That's Atlantic senior editor Derek Thompson speaking with me last February. Hitmakers, How to Succeed in an Age of Distraction, comes out in paperback on Tuesday.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punterful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Tomorrow, thousands of people will make the annual pilgrimage to Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, to watch a groundhog give a weather forecast. You know how this goes. If Punxsutawney Phil sees his shadow, it means six more weeks of winter. If he doesn't, and I really hope he doesn't, we get an early spring. Ann Danahy of member station WPSU embedded herself with Phil's inner circle as they prepared for the big day.
John Griffiths is chopping up vegetables for Phil's lunch.
I'm cutting up sweet potatoes, listeners.
The groundhog dines in style. Griffiths is a handler in what's known as Punxsutawney Phil's inner circle. His duties include everything from preparing snacks for the famous groundhog to handling him on Groundhog Day.
Cutting up an apple.
Punxsutawney Phil snacks on hand-cut fruits and vegetables and naps on a bed of hay. He and his groundhog wife, Phyllis, live in their own zoo at the town library. Visitors can peer in through an outside window. We turn to Phil and Phyllis for a sneak preview about what will happen tomorrow.
Do you want to tell me what you're going to forecast on Groundhog Day?
We took that as a filibuster. Griffith says the inner circle does not get inside information either.
You're saying that nobody knows ahead of time what's going to happen.
Absolutely not. My gosh.
Griffith has been a member of Phil's inner circle for about 20 years. As a handler, he works directly with Phil, often sporting a top hat and tuxedo. A.J. DeRoom is a newer member of the inner circle. He says Phil is the only weather forecasting groundhog in the world.
As we consider him, he is the king of the animal kingdom. We have to honor him, and we do that, you know, with the tuxedo and top hats.
They like to recognize his stature. Phil's inner circle insists the same groundhog has been making the prediction for more than 130 years. The secret, the elixir of life. One sip of the special drink gives Phil another 7 years. But what's in it? Griffiths won't say.
It's a secret that's been passed down from handler to handler for generations.
Another secret is how Phil gets from his home in the library to the big event which takes place at Gobbler's Knob outside of town. Griffiths likes to say Phil is taken by way of secret tunnels to throw off anyone who might be following them.
It's like a catacomb down there.
The tunnels are unconfirmed. However, Phil travels to Gobbler's Knob. Once he's there, he waits in a hollowed-out tree stump for the big moment. At about 7:25 in the morning, the president of the Inner Circle taps on the door 3 times. Phil is brought out, and it's up to the president to decipher whether Phil has seen his shadow. Griffiths says a cane made from the wood of an acacia tree allows President Bill Dealey to translate Phil's forecast.
He doesn't speak to Phil. This is kind of a misnomer going around. He interprets what Phil says through a series of whistles and clicks and any kind of noise that he makes.
The prediction, they say, is right every time. For Here and Now, I'm Ann Danahy.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no hill or mountain we can't climb.
I don't know. I'm suspicious. Now, if you've seen the movie by the same name, you know this song is the one that Bill Murray wakes up to each morning precisely at 6 a.m. as another Groundhog Day begins and begins and begins. The movie turns 25 this year. You're listening to Here and Now.
It is time now for a special Super Bowl edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Philadelphia Eagles and New England Patriots will face off in Super Bowl 52 this Sunday in the city of Minneapolis, a city with a rich music scene and history. And joining us to talk about that is Andrea Swenson, who is DJ and host of the local show on Minnesota Public Radio's The Current and author of Got to Be Something Here, The Rise of the Minneapolis Sound. I think, Andrea, that we found the best possible person to talk about the music of Minnesota. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And tell us about the music of Minnesota, first of all. What's the scene like there now?
It is enormous. It's actually really hard to describe because there are just so many different smaller scenes within the larger community. We have a really active hip-hop scene, really active indie rock, electronic. You can literally go out any night of the week and find something that you would like.
Well, let's listen to some of what you brought us. And this is from 1967. It's Wee Willie Walker with There Goes My Used to Be.
There goes my used to be. Oh, walking down the street. Saying hello, oh, oh, to every guy she meets. Oh, they just don't know. Oh, she'll break their heart. How do I know? She once broke.
Sounds like Sam Cooke, but it's actually a B-side to the Beatles cover, Ticket to Ride. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I think Wee Willie Walker is kind of the godfather of our soul scene in the Twin Cities. He's been making music here since the early 60s. He still performs today, and believe it or not, his voice still sounds like that. It's really incredible. And Willie had the chance to go down to Memphis and do a lot of sessions in the late 60s for the Gold Wax label, and I just think they're hidden gems in our Minnesota music history that have recently been unearthed.
Does race play a big role in the history of music in Minnesota?
It does. Yeah, that's a big thing that I get into in my book. A lot of people don't think that there was African-American music being made before Prince in Minneapolis, but there was actually very, very vibrant scenes in both North Minneapolis and this neighborhood called Rondo in St. Paul. And in recent years, I think a lot of attention has been turned towards that era and really wanting to understand more of these people that were predecessors to Prince and his peers.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Prince because we couldn't do this segment without talking about and listening to Prince. Here is Uptown.
Everybody's gonna
such a great song, but there are so many great Prince songs. Why did you pick this one?
Well, Uptown is a neighborhood in Minneapolis, and I think a lot of us here just feel really proud about that song that we're represented. And the mission behind that song is so cool. You know, all these different people from different backgrounds coming together, black, white, Puerto Rican, everybody a freakin'. I think that is so representative of just Prince's ethos and what he was all about.
How did he break out of the music scene in Minneapolis?
That is a great question. I think it had some to do with the manager that he partnered with in his early career. But there was also a very intentional goal on his part to break out of being labeled as a black artist. There were literally black charts, and then there were the pop charts where the white artists would be featured. And he really said to Warner Brothers, I want to be marketed as a pop artist. And that ended up being very revolutionary. I think that's why we saw his videos and Michael Jackson's videos as some of the first black art being featured on MTV.
And how often do you play Prince on your show?
Oh, every week. I live in Minnesota. I cover the Minnesota music scene. It's just part of what we talk about here. And I do a little music history spotlight every week. And very often it's something Prince related because there's just so many great stories to tell.
Yeah. And lucky you, there are so many Prince songs. So you probably don't have to play the same ones over and over again. Let's get to the next one you brought us. This is the Minneapolis native Dessa with Fire Drills.
I've been Wendy, living with the Lost Boys. Youth spent as a deckhand on the convoy. Moves every night to prove we were something. Got confused if it was from a two that we were running. I've seen Gibraltar, I've seen the Taj Mahal, Soweto, Hagia Sophia, Chef Sharon paints the walls blue. I've played to full rooms, I've played the fool too. Burning through the bottoms of a pair of new boots. Cut my hair, take my down. A woman on her own must be from out of town. Funny you don't know the concessions that you're making until you catalog them. And by then they're many, and you're battle-hardened. Heat makes liquid of the asphalt. Keepsakes and parking tickets on the dashboard. I'm here to file my report. Is the vixen of the wolf pack. Tell patient zero he can have his rib back.
Who is Dessa?
Dessa is a beloved figure in our Minnesota music scene. She's a writer, she's a rapper, she's about to publish her first full-length book. And in recent years, she's really turned the focus to her solo material. And as you can hear in that song, she just has a way with words. You can just listen to her music over and over again and keep catching something new.
And I hear that you often go stand out in the freezing cold to catch a show.
Yes, especially this week. They've got everything shut down and they've got a stage right in downtown. And people are literally standing for hours to listen to, just the other night, The Revolution was playing, Morris Day and the Time, Sheila E. I've been impressed with just how hearty and how ready people are to experience live music in January.
Okay, well, we've been talking about music from Minnesota, but while we have you here, we are going to give each team a chance to be represented by an artist. We're talking about the Philadelphia Eagles and the New England Patriots. Let's start with Philadelphia. This is a song from last year. It's called Just Can't Get Enough, and it's from the Philadelphia-based band Sheer Mag. I'm listening closely for the word cheesesteak, but I haven't heard it yet. Why did you pick this one to represent Philadelphia?
I just love Sheer Mag. They're a relatively new group from Philly. You know, listening to it, you might think they're from the 70s. That record, as you mentioned, just came out last year. But I love the way that they combine punk rock with this 70s kind of classic rock guitar influence. And that lead singer just has so much personality. I just love listening to them.
Okay, and for the New England Patriots, today we have the song Roadrunner by the Boston area group The Modern Lovers.
Outside.
See, now I thought you were going to pick maybe the Standells, Love That Dirty Water. Tell me about this one.
This is just such a great song, too. It was recorded back in 1972, but just recently they were considering it to making it the Massachusetts state song, and I just thought that was so fascinating. I mean, he does say, "I'm in love with Massachusetts" in there, so that probably pleases a lot of people. But Jonathan Richman is the lead singer and songwriter in that group, and he is just kind of a punk icon, so I wanted to give a little shout-out to him.
And by the way, the state song of Massachusetts right now is something called All Hail to Massachusetts, which I haven't heard before, but we'll look it up and see if we can find it. Andrea Swenson, DJ and host of the local show on Minnesota Public Radio's The Current in Minneapolis, where Super Bowl 52 is happening this weekend. Are you going? Do you have tickets, Andrea?
I do not have tickets to the actual game. I will be standing outside with the rest of us in Minnesota.
All right. Well, bundle up. Andrea, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All hail to Massachusetts.
There it is. All rise. It's here and now.
For Bunker Hill and Charlestown and the flag we love.
Earlier this week, a former Major League Baseball player named Marcos Carvajal died in his native Venezuela because he could not get the antibiotics he needed to treat a case of pneumonia. He is another casualty of the growing crisis in that country. Since 2012, under President Nicolas Maduro, Venezuela has been stuck in a devastating economic and political spiral. And one consequence has been a severe shortage of medicine. Francisco Valencia leads a public health advocacy group called Code Vida. He joins us now from Caracas on Skype. Francisco, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, I'm afraid to say that the death of this former professional baseball player, still a very young man, was probably not a surprise to you.
No, it's not, because for us, it's a daily basis receiving calls from people who die because of lack of medicines.
How bad is the shortage? We're hearing estimates that up to 85% of the drugs that people need aren't available.
Yeah. Right now, we live in Venezuela, a humanitarian crisis. We register 85% of shortage of essential medicines like hypertension, diabetes, medicines, even basic medicines that you need for, you know, protect from your fevers and everything. And the other thing is that we are having a 90% shortage of medicines for people who has cancer, has received a transplant, organ donation, or HIV people. And recently, last night, we received the news that 16,000 people who received dialysis has run out of equipment, and the life is at risk, because you know that people in dialysis, they need to receive dialysis, because if not, they will be dead soon.
So, of course, many people in your country must be desperate over this. What ends are people going to get their drugs? Is there a black market? Are they smuggling drugs in from other countries, leaving Venezuela to get health care?
We have a lot of migrations to the countries nearby Venezuela, like Colombia and Brazil, looking for medicines and obviously food. The emergency we have here is not only medicine and food, too. We have two medicines that come from Colombia, not the right way. We don't know if they're good or bad, but they sell it at the price, at the black market price, very high, and very few people have access to those medicines.
What about you? Does it affect you personally?
Well, on myself, I have a kidney transplant 18 years ago, and I haven't received my medicine since August last year. Right now, I'm taking medicines that have been expired. Not only me, my wife, I had received a transplant too, and she's at risk too.
How does this fit into the larger context of the healthcare system in Venezuela? We've seen reports that some hospitals don't have electricity. We've also seen that doctors are leaving the country in droves. It's not just medicine, it's the entire healthcare system.
We have around 10,000 doctors who left the country because they don't have, you know, how to proceed with the patients, and they don't receive the proper payment here in Venezuela. So they have left to South America, where they receive payments in U.S. dollars. And that's a big problem, because 10,000 doctors is a big group of doctors who live in the hospitals in Venezuela. What we're seeing in the hospital is very sad. They don't give food to the patients in the hospital. They only give juice but they don't give food to the people who are in the hospital. Recently, we have received report that 300 hospitals in Venezuela has serious problem with equipment, diagnostic equipment, like X-ray equipment. They don't have proper medical supplies to, you know, to take care of the people who go to the emergency, like gloves, like, you know, every basic thing they need for an emergency. Huh. So it's very complex here in Venezuela, and it's going to be devastated if the government doesn't take action soon.
So the question is, I think, what is at the root cause of this? We've been reporting for quite a while now about the economic crisis in Venezuela, the inflation that has reached nearly 2,000%. The Maduro government has been accused of cracking down on protesters. How is all that related to the fact that you can't get medicine in the country?
It is related because Maduro hasn't invested in the health system. We have been having like 10 health minister. They change the health minister every year, and that's a big problem too. And the corruption. Corruption is a big issue here in Venezuela in the health system, because when they assign U.S. dollar to buy equipment or medicine, we don't see that it comes to Venezuela. So the question is, where is the money? Where the money goes? And that's one of the biggest issues that we are here right now in the big crisis in Venezuela. And the main is that the corruption is very big, and the government has to take actions immediately, asking for humanitarian aid. But they don't want that, and they deny that they're living a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela.
Yeah.
In the meantime, people are dying every day because they don't have the proper medicine.
Yeah. And meanwhile, the Maduro government says U.S. sanctions are to blame for this health crisis. Francisco Valencia joining us from Caracas, where shortages of medicine are leading to people's deaths. Francisco, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.